Hello, welcome to The Musics in Japan,
a conversational podcast about daily life for an American couple living long-term in Japan.
So lately I've been thinking about letting people in and dropping down my wall and being really vulnerable. And I want to say the process started about a year ago. When did I come out as hard of hearing?
I think it's been about a year.
Okay. So part of this is something that's really hard for me. And that is that I have always worked really hard to, while I own that I'm Black, and I introduce myself as Black, and I am super proud of being Black, I do make sure that my Black is always palatable. And I think that for me, the Black Lives Matter movement is just not about cops killing Black people. It is absolutely about that. It's about the quality of life for Black people. There's not a moment of the day, of any day, that I am not aware of the fact that I am Black. And if you go to our Twitter page and you see me sitting next to my husband in the photo, we look damn near the same color. But I have never passed for white. Nobody has ever not known that there's something not quite white about me. And people my whole life have asked me, except for Black folks, they know I'm Black. But people who aren't Black have asked me my whole life, what are you? Which is such a demeaning question. What are you? And that has stuck with me my whole life and has really for a lot of years damaged me. And now it doesn't. And that's not the most damaging thing. I've been called every racial slur in the book, even for races that I don't belong to. And I believe we're all part of the human race, so ethnicities that I don't belong to. And I feel like, for me being a part of this conversation is lending my privilege because colorism is a thing. And there are spaces in which my Blackness is palatable because I'm pale and I'm just light enough and I'm just not really Black. And I've had people tell me, well, you're not really Black. And I'm like, yes, I am. I'm Black. And it's so painful and exhausting to have to start every new relationship with I'm Black so that they don't do the racist crap that they do when they don't know I'm Black, because I've made that mistake just thinking I can just be and have people just be horrible. The reason that Chad and I are doing this episode together is because I believe people listen to people that look like them. So when it comes to talking to Japanese nationals about Black Lives Matter, our son Rasta is the most fluent in Japanese, and he's taking on that education burden and responsibility in a time of great pain and a time of great somberness. Chad is taking on the responsibility of speaking to white people because he is white. And why is he shouting Black Lives Matter?
I think because people don't listen otherwise. I think that there's a lot of... See, I think the thing about, like, we're all part of the human race is one of those things that while it's technically true, it's so often misused and subverted.
Yeah.
That you kind of have to say, okay, this is true but irrelevant. It's a non sequitur. Like when you say that you always make sure that people know you're Black when you introduce yourself, but that you try to be, I forget how you phrase it, but I think of it as one of the respectable Blacks.
Yeah, a palatable level of Blackness.
Right. That in itself, that concept itself implies that there is a certain burden to identifying as Black, that it carries with it certain assumptions. When people hear that you're Black, they say, okay, well, you know, here's what your standard Black person is like.
Don't make her mad.
Right. For example,
people tell me, ooh, you must have a bad temper.
Right.
Because I must be an angry Black woman, and damn straight I am an angry Black woman.
Right.
But...
And I think there's that stereotype about so many different ethnicities. And so I find that, like, talking to white people in particular, some of the more quote-unquote liberal white people are like, well, ethnicity is culture. So you can't say that being Black is an ethnicity because, well, being Igbo is an ethnicity.
Yeah, and...
And being Nigerian is a nationality, but what's being Black?
Being Black is being killed by the police. Being Black is when I was 25 years old, I was in a, I drove up to Oregon, and driving from California to Oregon, every single day, I was pulled over by the police. I was driving the speed limit. I wasn't breaking laws. Every single day, I was stopped by the police. I was pulled out of my car for not speeding, for not doing anything, because I looked like a gang member.
Mm-hmm.
And I was driving a white car. It was a classic car. And they pulled me out of my car every single day. And when I was living, because when my mother was dying, I lived in Oregon. My mother lived in Coquille, Oregon. And I would drive back and forth to work every day. And the same state trooper would pull me over every single day and search my car and frisk me and say to me, one day I'm going to catch you. And I didn't know
what he was going to catch you at.
Yeah, I didn't know what he was talking to you, and I would just respond, no, sir, I always follow laws. And he would have these really racist conversations with me. Like, you know, the city that you're in was one of the last cities in Oregon to take down the no N-word allowed sign. And then there were, we don't like coloreds, literally in some of the restaurant windows in this town. And it was so incredibly painful for me.
Yeah.
And the assumption that I was on welfare, and the, like, every single day for 3 months, this state trooper took a picture of my one tattoo that I had on my wrist. Every single day. And mind you, I was up there because my mother was in the hospital. She had had a stroke and she was dying. And so I was up there every single day driving to and from work.
Until she did die.
Until she did die because, and it was just, it was horrific. So I would go visit my mother in the morning. I would bathe her. She had lost her ability to speak. And if y'all follow us on Twitter, you know my relationship with my mother is very fraught and very difficult. So I had that whole twisted thing up in my head dealing with that. And then knowing that I would be stopped. And there were some days that literally in the span of a 45-minute drive, I would be stopped 5 times. And they all knew my name. And they were like, do you have your driver's license with you? Why is it a California driver's license? Why are your plates still California? I'm like, because I'm not moving here. I'm not moving here. I'm just here. And they knew my story. And they would say, when is your mother going to die so you can get out of our city?
Mm-hmm.
We're sick of seeing you. And I would think in my head, I'm sick of seeing you too. I'm sick of you groping me and copying a feel every time you frisk me. I'm being groped by the police. I'm having my car ransacked. So there's absolutely nothing in my car at this point except just the documents that need to be. And I know the officers' names, and I don't complain because their boss has been in on it. And so I had state police and sheriffs and just every law enforcement agency stop and search me. And in the drive back after my mother died, I was stopped in every single city between Coquille, Oregon and San Jose, California. I was stopped in every single city, and not once did I ever speed. Not once was I ever speeding. And every single time that I was stopped, that police officer had his hands on his gun, and every single time I was stopped, I was afraid for my life. Every single time. And it's so hard. It's so... It's hard to breathe. I can't breathe. It's just so crushing. What it's so difficult to explain what that's like. It's so difficult to explain what it's like being 5 years old and practicing hiding under the blanket in the back seat because we have entered the South. So we always knew whenever we crossed the California state line every summer when I was with my mom, we would drive cross country. And we would practice in California getting under the seat and pulling things on top of us. So we had this makeshift setup to make it look like it's not people under it for me and my brother. Because when we entered into Texas specifically, that was the time when we would have to practice going under the blanket. We were not able to have our heads above the window. We were always supposed to be below the window because as we were driving through the southern states, this was in the 70s, it was very clear to us. Our mother had to explain to us that she would be taken into custody, beaten, and raped because she had given birth to two black children, and she would be considered a race traitor. And we would be taken into custody and removed from her care. And that conversation, I never got how hard that conversation must have been for my mother. And so I had the conversation with my son about what to do if he is ever pulled over by the police when he went to Australia. About, you know, keep your hands on the wheel. Do not take your hands off of the wheel until you have permission from the officer. Roll your window down. Ask permission for everything that you do. Do not take your hands off the steering wheel. If they say, give us your license, say where your license is. Ask for permission to get your license out. Tell him every step of the way what you're doing. I'm opening my bag. I'm getting my wallet. Make sure that they can see in your bag. Make sure that they can see in your wallet. Make sure that you do not scare the person with the gun. And our son is 5'5" and
he's 5'7".
Okay, I think he's 5'5", but okay, give him his.
It's just because of how much taller I am.
Okay, he's 5'. Yeah, he's 5'7" and weighs 125 pounds, soaking wet. He's so thin that we worry about him because sometimes he gets so thin you can actually see his heart beating in his chest. He is a wisp of a person, but he has an afro.
Yeah.
And that's when I got how hard that conversation was for my mother. But I also know that every single time we were pulled over on that drive from California to Alabama, I would piss myself. Mm-hmm. And it was such a common thing that whenever I saw a police officer, I would wet my pants, that it became normalized for me. That, it's okay, let's get you cleaned up. It's not a big deal. Guns are scary. And having to be okay, but being terrified every time I saw a police officer that he was going to kill my mother for having given birth to me. That hasn't changed. That hasn't changed. And so when people are asking, why are we so angry? It's because we're having the same conversation where this conversation hasn't changed. It's the conversation that has been existing for me my entire life. It's the conversation that existed for my grandmother. It didn't exist for my great-grandfather because he was a slave. So
That was a different conversation.
Yeah. So, I mean, you wonder why I can't breathe. It's because I can't do what I normally do to not think about all of that. Because here's the thing. Every time a police officer has stopped me and pulled a gun on me, I have then just gone about my day like that's normal. Like, for me, it was just normal. It was to the point when I was doing that 45-minute drive to work, I would just pull over. Like, we had a designated pullover and search Christopher spot. And at the time, I was 5'4" and literally 105 pounds. And this man, who's just a mountain of a man, would just tell me horrific racist stories and what could happen to me and what could be done to me. And I had no choice. I had to go to work.
Yeah.
And I had to drive. And after being threatened horrible things by an officer of the law, I would then go to work. Mm-hmm. And then it would happen again as I was leaving work. And then I would just go take care of my dying mother. And that was just, I just kept it moving. And I'm having a hard time right now keeping it moving.
Yeah.
So no, I can't breathe. And yes, I need to tweet out Black Lives Matter. And I'm trying to keep it positive. I'm trying to step into the LGBTQIA+ part of it. But my trans siblings, my Black trans siblings, are just being slaughtered for existing. It's just, there's no safe haven. There's no place for me to exist that's safe. Even in Japan, where for the most part it's not being screamed at me, the police stop Rasta, who drives, our son Rasta, who drives, and have, you know, frisked him and sat in his car and searched his car, and he gets stopped while riding a bike. Like, he's been stopped by the police 3 times, and that's amazing to me. He's 25 years old, and he's only been stopped by the police 3 times in his life, and it's stunning to me. That number is so small, and other people might be like, wow, that's, you know, he's doing nothing wrong. He's following the speed limits, and he's riding a bike he owns 3 times. That's outrageous. And I'm like, that's amazing on the positive.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So, yeah. What's your experience been with the police?
My experience with the police has been mixed. So I think that first I have to separate out. So my father was an attorney, but before that he was police. And my involvement with the police when my father has been involved has been universally negative. I never felt like I was personally in danger, but it was always clear that they were there to enforce his rights to abuse me without consequence. So on that, I've always seen the police as there to enforce the social order without regard to whether it's good or bad.
But this is profound. This is profound. And this is what people need to get. My white husband was afraid of the police as a child because he got that they were there to uphold his white father's rights. So this isn't just about Black people. This is about your right as women. This is about children's rights. This is about everybody's rights who aren't part of the status quo, who aren't part of the power structure.
Right. So I think the stakes were always different. So for me, the stakes were always that if I spoke up, then, you know, well, you know, we could find something to arrest you for, that kind of thing. It wasn't, we're going to shoot you.
Yeah.
I don't feel like my life has ever been endangered by the police except for one time, which I'll talk about. And then when I was living on my own in Fairbanks, it was being hassled by the police because I was poor. And I say hassled because I wasn't threatened, I was just hassled. They would pull me over because they would be like, well, your car, which wasn't even my car, is run down. So, you know, here's something you need to fix. And sometimes it was like, okay, yes, I should fix that. And other times it was like, your tires are too bald. Well, there's no law against having bald tires, but you need an excuse to pull me over and say something. I get that me being poor was offensive, but I never felt in danger from that. I felt hassled. And again, it was about upholding the social order. Like, don't make things
uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable. Right. And then with the police in California, I didn't really have any interactions. I don't think at all with the police in California. Except for once when our business was vandalized. And once when my car was vandalized.
Yeah.
And they came out and they were like, when my car was vandalized, they were like, well, there's nothing you could do, but here's your police report so you can file an insurance claim.
Yeah.
And when the business was vandalized, they did find the guy who did it. I don't know what happened after that, but I think nothing. In both cases, the police did not actually do anything to help. So when people are like, well, if there were no police, what would happen if you got robbed? The same shit that happens now.
Yeah.
Nothing.
I've had the police, everyone's like, California's so liberal, California's so liberal. No, it's not as liberal as you think. So I have been stopped by the police for wearing shorts while pushing my son in a stroller.
Mm-hmm.
Literally. Because they felt that I was indecently exposed and they were trying to arrest me for prostitution. And I was walking down the street from my house, down the street a block to the local 7-Eleven where they know me.
Right.
And I knew all my neighbors, and my neighbors were like, so I did live in a gang affiliated neighborhood. And so they'd be like, yo, man, don't leave her alone. And there was always witnesses. So I feel like the reason that I was never arrested was because there were too many witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they were actually afraid because they were outnumbered. And so I've had police follow me to my home. I've had police knock on my door and accuse me of crimes when I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I've had the police come knock on my door and accuse me of dealing drugs, which was bizarre and strange. I've had the police follow me into when I was parking and outside my vehicle to try and cite me for a moving violation. The most stunning for me was when the cops followed me all the way to my home, and I parked and I got out, and the senior officer wanted to write me a ticket, and the junior officer was like, no, we should just let her go. And he's like, no, they'll never learn. And I could see the junior officer being stunned and confused, and they had a discussion that was really bizarre to watch, and then they decided to not give me a ticket. And it was terrifying for me.
Yeah.
Because the senior officer was getting more and more heated, and the junior officer was like, and this was amazing. The junior officer was like, I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
And risking insubordination. I don't know if the junior officer left the force or what have you, but I feel like that junior officer talked a senior officer through the argument of arresting me.
Right.
And I was like, please stop defending me. I was thinking in my mind, please stop. Just let me get the ticket. Let me get the ticket and go about my day. I don't want to be arrested for your sense of morality. And then they drove off. But for me, I've always been harassed by the police. I think I know the incident you're talking about where you were afraid for your life.
Yeah.
When was that?
That was when we had already moved to Japan, but we went back to the United States. And we drove across country and went to see Niagara Falls and everything. And in Idaho, we got pulled over. And because of the way that Kisra was driving, because of the way that she had pulled over, which was the right way in California, and this is what the officer said, he approached the car with his gun drawn. And I believe intending to shoot Christopher until he saw Rasta, who was 12 or 13 at the time, and me in the car, and was like, oh man, I'd have to murder three people, and I was only ready to murder one.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I find it difficult to frame it any other way than he robbed us at gunpoint.
Yes.
Because although you were speeding, he said, well, in Idaho, for people who aren't from Idaho, we have a special kind of ticket, and you just give me $80 right now, and then there's no ticket in the system.
Yes.
So in Idaho, we had an officer rob us at gunpoint because Kisfer's black.
Yes. And he said, another officer has been killed. He wanted to kill me in retaliation for a different officer being shot, not killed. And there was no news or incident report that verified what he was saying. So you know, he just...
It happened 50 years ago, but it happened.
Yeah. And I was just like, this is so bizarre. I was shaken for a few minutes and he was like, you need to go now. And so before I could even compose myself, he was like, get back on the road. And I was not safe to drive. We were not allowed to change drivers.
Right.
And I was pulling out and driving really slow. And he was like, speed it up. And I was like, it just got pulled over and you just pulled your gun on me for speeding. It was just like, I was terrified. And I was like, okay, this is it. And that's just like, for me, it just, it leaves me speechless now for me to be like, okay, this is it. This is how we die.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, there wasn't any recourse for me. There's, in my mind, there's no recourse. There's nothing I can do. Okay, this, I'm dying now. This is what's going to happen. And I'm just thinking to myself, it's been great though.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, I'm thinking, but I've, for the most part, I've had, you know, these high moments. So that's the police side of things.
Yes, I do want to say one more. So I know that some people are like, don't say all cops are bastards. And I don't think they are, but I think that the ones who aren't quickly become socialized into being. I have met one person in my entire life who is an exception. And he was my political science professor. He's black, which is relevant. And he had been on the force for 30 years. And people ask him how he was on the force for 30 years. He said, 1 week after I graduated from the academy, I joined internal affairs, and I spent 30 years taking down dirty cops.
Yeah.
Said, and we never ran out of cops to take down. He was involved in setting up sting operations for cops who were raping and robbing and killing and in the San Jose area. So,
and beating their wives and intimate partners.
So that was like his entire career. He said, I never had anything to do with the civilian population. The only people that I ever dealt with in my job were cops. And they were either the other cops in IA or the cops who were busting. He's the only cop that I've ever met who I don't think either started out wanting to use violence against people or ended up that way because they were socialized that or quit.
So on the daily life side of things, I have been standing in line at a deli counter and had the person who was making sandwiches refuse to take my order until every white person who was behind me had been served.
Mm-hmm.
I have been in line to buy movie tickets and had the person who was buying movie tickets refuse to sell me a ticket until the people behind me had been served. Most of my life, whenever I've done any type of shopping or social event, I've always had a white person with me. Yeah. I just developed the habit of having one white friend always.
Mm-hmm.
And hanging out with them and having them go, even if I would pay. And I didn't realize that I had done this until we were hanging out as friends.
Mm-hmm.
And you were like, no, no, you go, you order. And what happened when you were like, no, no, you go before me?
I don't remember.
So when we went, so I wouldn't go back to places. So people say don't go back to places that treat you this way.
But you run out of places.
Yes. So like at my local, there were 3 different convenience stores around our house. All 3 convenience stores had done it. So for me to find a convenience store that had never done that to me, like a 7-Eleven or Quick Stop or what have you, I would have to drive 30 minutes away from where I lived to go to the convenience store. If I wanted to...
And nobody was giving you that gas for free.
Right. If I wanted to get gas at a gas station, that never happened. That gas station was 45 minutes from where I lived.
Yeah.
So Chad and I are standing in line, and I was like, I always had him order, you order. And the lady at the counter said next, and I was standing there, and I walked up, and she looked around me, leaned over, which is ironic because you're taller than me, she didn't need to lean, but just really wanted me to know in a pointed manner.
Yeah.
And she said, sir, what would you like to order? And you said, uh-uh, she's ordering.
Yeah.
And then I placed the order for both of us, and then you spoke to the manager and ranted and raved. And here's the trippy part. Chad was flaming pissed. I was not. I was just like, I just want to get my sandwich and go. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
And so Chad's education and revolution of understanding racism, he would listen to me and my friends talk about our lived experiences, and he was like, I've never witnessed that. But as Black people, we forget how much we just accept all of these microaggressions, and how much we just, if we're in a group, we just let the white friend order. If we're paying for something, we don't get outraged when they give our change to the white person in our group. We're just happy when they give it back to us. We don't complain when the police officer stops us for walking or just being ourselves. We just get on with life. We don't complain when we're not included on the email chain. We don't complain when it just, the list goes on and on. We don't complain when they say they don't have our shoe size, even though we have the standard foot size. So I have the standard foot size. I don't complain when they say they don't carry my shoe size, except for one time I did, because I was at a high-end store, and it was so bad the way that they treated me that I went back and complained, and the person was subsequently fired because they treated me so bad.
It was Neiman Marcus. I don't mind saying it.
Okay. And so, for me, I feel like there's so many things that you just reach a point when it's like, I can't take it anymore. Because all of these things is how people get to the place where it's okay to kill us. Now it's okay to kill us when we're sleeping in our bed. When is it going to stop? When is this going to stop? And that's why Black Lives Matter is a global movement. It is global. We are here in Japan, and we are marching for our rights in Tokyo. I personally can't march because of COVID, and I have lupus and hereditary coprophilia. And so what I'm doing is this podcast, and I'm using my social media platform to educate. So I have been finding videos that are children friendly for our allies to show their children. I have been finding books. I have been elevating scholars, and I have been retweeting Black artists. And for me, if saying Black Lives Matter is controversial, what the fuck is wrong with you? Saying that my life matters is controversial, and you're not doing that on your social media performative support because of what your friends might think of you, then girl, bye. Like, just leave. And I'm just so hurt and angry at all of the people who are acting like this is something that's up for debate. That's saying that my life matters is something that's up for debate. It's too radical an idea to say that my life matters to you. And so, yes, we have been doing a purge on our social media of people who feel like that's too radical an idea. We have lost followers on our social media, and I'm like, thank goodness I didn't know that you were a racist. So it is not enough that you are not racist. That's not enough. You need to talk to people about why you think my life matters, because you might change their mind. You have to use your influence and privilege to elevate the voices. So if you don't feel comfortable using the hashtag, just retweet, just promote Black artists, just elevate melanated voices. Follow melanated people. If you like video games, find out what video game was made by a Black person and then go buy it and game. What we choose to spend our money on will change the world, because green is the language everybody understands and is the color that everyone can agree on if you're American, because Americans have green money, but Japan doesn't. But you get what I'm saying. Money matters. And when we put our money where our morals are, I believe we can change the world. Brands that are doing performative, like L'Oreal, who dropped a prominent trans woman from their campaign and is now saying Black Lives Matter, well, they dropped that trans model because she was saying Black Lives Matter. So look at their history. Don't let the brands just slap up Black Lives Matter and be like, oh, they're down. Look at Ben and Jerry's. Look at Lego. That's how you do it. Because look at Seth Rogen. That's how you do it. There are people that are doing more than performative, and find Black leaders and follow their accounts and boost their voices. And if people are just putting Black Lives Matter next to their name, that's not enough. Are they elevating melanated voices? Are they, you know, inhabiting the hashtag? Are they sharing books? Are they sharing resources? Are they actually engaging in allyship that is beyond performative? And for all of you that put the black tile out on Blackout Tuesday, that was performative and it was wrong and it was hurtful to the movement. Listen to the leaders of the movement. And if you don't know who they are, Google that shit. See who the leaders are in your city, in your town. And I feel like for me, Ice Cube and Ice-T are always on point. They've been on point my entire life. And I know Ice-T is light-skinned with light eyes just like me. And we have fought for our blackness because of colorism and all of those kinds of things that are not appropriate for this episode. Because we value our blackness, because even though it hurts to be black, it is my strength and my honor to be black. What do you think, babe?
I think that the amount of strength that it takes for you is both astonishing and a shame. It shouldn't be that way.
And you're saying the strength for me to get up every morning and function.
Yes.
Because being black is not a choice.
Yes. I am. Yes. And I think that when we look at saying Black Lives Matter, I think the revolutionary part of that, the part that makes people uncomfortable, is that Black Lives Matter movement is not about being content with the place that Black people have in society. So I think if you look at, like, a lot of people criticizing the NFL, which, just in a statistical sense, Black players in the NFL, much higher percentage than Black people in the United States. But if you look at who the GMs are, if you look at who the coaches are, if you look at who the owners are, Black people are not overrepresented. So we have a sport where we're quite happy for Black players to be overrepresented, and the people who go out there and get hurt, get permanently, many of them permanently disabled by playing for our entertainment.
Yeah.
We're happy with Black gladiators, but we don't want Black generals.
Yeah. So we've been with CAP since the beginning. We stopped our affiliation with the NFL. I was a huge football fan, and he was before his time, but he is a revolutionary.
Yeah.
And taking a knee was an act of revolution. And I find it interesting that y'all want to protest because you can't go to the beach, but then when we want to protest because you're killing us, whoa, that's too far. And I know that this episode has been all over the place and raw and angry and probably not my most eloquent moment. But fuck you if you expect eloquence right now, is just where I'm at. Just really. I can't breathe. And getting up and functioning and being a therapist, I will be honest, I've had to reduce the amount of clients that I work with. And I've had to, there are certain clients that I'm not able to work with right now. And I'm so tired, and I can't sleep, I can't think, and I can't breathe.
And that's sad. And it's sad in a way that it's like, makes me angry. It makes me angry that you feel like you have to justify why you're not going the 200 miles to Tokyo to march during the middle of a pandemic to try and get somebody in the United States to pay attention.
So trip on that. If you're not doing anything to support this movement, if you think not being racist is enough, you're wrong. You need to be anti-racist. And if you think, you know, elevating melanated voices is too far, really? To save a life? To save a life. To save the life of a human being. You don't want to risk what?
Clout.
And for me, I feel like there's so much more clout in being human.
If your clout is based on Black racism. Lives, is based on Black lives not mattering, then you should rethink your choices in life.
Yes. If you stuck around this long, thank you. And we hope that you follow us over to Patreon and do something. Please, do something. Tweet the hashtag. Follow a Black person on Instagram and hit their comment section and shower them with love. Tell a Black friend, I see you and I love you and I am here for you. Go on Google and Google Black businesses in your town or if they're not in your town, hit them up and order from them on Amazon.
Well, online, I would say.
Yeah, online. Sorry, Amazon's a shitty company. But I'm not going to pretend like they haven't cornered the market.
Yeah, but there are black businesses selling directly online. They're choosing not to be part of
Amazon. So buy directly from them if you can. If not, use some sort of service. Donate to the ACLU. Donate to the NAACP. There's so many things you can do, you know? But do something. And I don't pretend to have all of the answers, and I am not perfect.
And again, you don't need to be. Yeah. That's not the standard. That should not be the standard for your voice to matter. That should not be the standard for your life to matter.
And do you see how ingrained in me that it is? Because right now, I'm not trying to be palatable. And I feel afraid. There's fear in not being palatable.
Yeah.
So on that note, thank you for listening. And we're going to head on over to Patreon and do the take two. And we hope that you come with us. Black Lives Matter.
And we hope you'll be back next week. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening. You can keep the conversation going on our website at themusicsinjapan.com. That's the music spelled M-U-S-I-C-K-S. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at The Musics on both.
And if you'd like to support us, please visit our website to sign up for our newsletter, join a Patreon tier, or send us a one-time donation through PayPal or Ko-fi. We hope you'll listen again next week.
Bye.